Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 40 of Undermine, brought to you by Osiris Media. I guess this is the episode where we're over the hill, 40. Oh, to be young again. Oh, to be 1.0 again. I'm Tom Marshall, your host, your guide, your time-traveling show Sherpa, as we revisit and relive Fish's famous Fall 97 tour. That's the tour where Fish destroyed America, and we are diving into each show of that tour on the actual 25th anniversary of when it was played. So that is what we've been up to. Thank you for asking. And joining me on this journey is my frequent co-host, New York Times bestselling author and one-time roller coaster engineer, Benji Eisen.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, you talk about it all the time, Benji. Were you really a roller coaster engineer?
No, that was actually my first dream job, until I found out that the math required was quite plentiful. So I settled for a co-host on Undermine instead, where I get to say things like this. If you've been enjoying talking our fish talk with us, then please consider joining Osiris Premium so that we can blaze onwards. You'll get bonus episodes of Undermine and HF Pod, ad-free episodes, access to the Under the Scales archives, meet and greets, AMAs, and even a chance to guest on one of our shows. So check out osirispod.com/premium, or to make it easy, just click on the link in the show notes. You know, talking of show notes, here is the notes on this show. See what I did there? It is now December 5th, 2022, sure, but also 1997, according to our DeLorean clock. That means that we are in Cleveland, Ohio. So as bassist Derek Smalls would say, hello, Cleveland.
Or look out, Cleveland.
That's right. And tonight, we're at a venue that neither Spinal Tap nor the band has played in. It is the CSU Convocation Center. Tom, do you know what convocation means?
On this night, it meant a very large gathering of fish fans.
That is right. Fish heads, fish kids, us. And that includes our guest today, who I understand is someone that you might already know.
Yes. And, you know, our normal tradition is to have our guest in the waiting room. And those of you who can see on YouTube, don't tell anyone who the guest is. Well, actually, maybe it's time for us to tell. Most of our listeners know exactly who this person is. It's our CEO here at the OSIRIS campus. It's RJB. I'm going to bring him in from the waiting room. Click. But Benji, there's one more thing you have to say, and it's going to make RJ super happy.
Well, you know, we do want to make RJ very happy, super happy, as it were. So I am excited, actually, to hear his memories from this night. But look, we all have memories of these Fall 97 shows. You're hearing ours, and we want to hear yours. And we will, if you just simply make a one-minute video clip, share your story, tell your tale, take us back to Fall 97. If you post the video on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, and tag OSIRISPOD, you will automatically be entered into our fun little game in which a random storyteller will get the handwritten lyrics to Ghost, care of the song's lyricist, who also happens to be the charming middle-aged man that I'm looking at right now. It's Tom Marshall. Thanks for writing those lyrics, Tom. You know, I have been stealing your lines since I was about 18.
Well, now I get a chance to return the favor, I hope. But without further fanfare, our guest has been very patient waiting. Let's bring him in. The former and future Undermine co-host, RJB. Hi, RJ. How are you?
Oh, man. This is quite a ride, guys. Is this how it always is?
Yep. It's like a roller coaster with Benji, always.
Come ups and downs.
I feel like I kind of missed. I was really like looking forward to finally seeing what it was like to be in the waiting room. And, you know, I kind of got short shrifted. There must be something awesome back there that you guys don't want me to see.
It's like being in Bed Bath and Beyond.
I've heard the waiting room, and we've not been in there ourselves, is phenomenal. Every single guest comes out there just ready to rock. So I'm sorry to deprive you of the waiting room.
I'll survive, probably.
So, RJ, you've been seeing fish, talking fish, and podcasting fish for so long now. And by way of guest introduction, tell us when, why, and how you first got into talking about fish on fish podcasts.
Oh, man. Everyone who does this does such a good job of keeping it short, which is hard. I saw my first show in the fall of 95 at the Palace of Auburn Hills, the show that we'll be talking about, that's not true at all. We won't be talking about that show. But I saw my first show in the fall of 95 at the Palace of Auburn Hills. I've been collecting tapes for a while and, you know, finally got to a show. I was 16 then, and I don't know how my parents let me drive, you know, an hour and a half to go see fish when I was 16 with a bunch of friends who were also 16. It sounds incredibly dangerous, but that started it all. And this was my I don't know, probably 10th or so show between 95 and 97, and the beginning of a 3-night run: Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Cleveland, Detroit, Dayton. I was a freshman in college at Ohio State, so like, you know, hitting Cleveland, Detroit, and Dayton, and then back to Columbus was like kind of a perfect circle. So that's how I ended up here on a Friday night.
Triangle, actually.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. RJ, we're going to give you a hardball question off the bat. Was the famous Mockingbird real or a hoax? never mind. We promised that we wouldn't get into politics here, so let's stick with fish. Tell us about this venue and why you chose to see fish here.
Yeah, it's a good question. So they played here before, and all I remember about it really was that we were page side about like halfway up the first level, and you know, we were, I guess at this point I was 18, so like, you know, I don't think we really knew what we were doing ever, you know, in general. But I think getting to Cleveland to get to the show, I remember it being cold and there was kind of a snowy weekend. And I feel like we almost missed the opener, and we like walked into our seats right when the opener started, which, you know, these days, like, that's pretty rare that that happens. But, you know, I just can't even believe that we made it.
That's awesome. Everyone keeps talking about this being cold and the weather now, like 25 years to the day when this show happened, isn't as cold as it was, or I remember it being back then. I wonder what's happening, if anything's happening that's making the world warmer. But no politics, right? We've been remembering that back in 1997, you couldn't just go to Live Fish to download the show from the night before. And in fact, it could take weeks or months before you get tapes from the show. And it was usually one at a time through the U.S. Postal Service. Did you get any fall 97 tapes before this night? Or was this show your first introduction to this tour?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that I got the Denver tapes. I think I was starting to get them. Benji, tell me if this sounds right. I feel like I was getting them like 2 weeks after the show happened. And I think that we had the first fall tapes like on the way to this show. And I don't think we had heard anything else. We had heard summer and I'd been to some summer shows, but this was like, I was probably prepping for what fall 95 sounded like or fall 97 sounded like on the way to the show, which is crazy, right? I mean, they're like, you've talked about this a bunch, Benji, where you can, you know, I listened to the show that I went to last night. I mean, it's not even the next day. It's immediate, you know,
on the way home in the hotel room, you know, yeah. Et cetera. Yeah. And we start to take that for granted. But at the time we had to really work for it. I remember leaving shows in fall 97 being like, I can't wait for 2 weeks from now when I can hear that again. RJ, you know, people love to call fall 97 the Cal Funk tour. And I think that we sometimes focus too much on that aspect and we forget that in 1997, Fish's hands were faster than guns. You know, in fact, that was actually one of the band's advertising slogans for the tour. Their hands are faster than guns.
Yeah.
So this show starts off heavy on the Cal Funk, but it gets shreddier and shreddier and then, you know, right through the Jimi Hendrix encore. So let's dive right into it. Set one opens with Ghost.
Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't hit the depths of like the Denver version, but it's a great opening. It kind of hits some of those same points, you know, where they start to get into the major key a little bit, but it doesn't go that far. I remember as Ghost, before it goes into Wilson, I remember the lights going down like almost completely or completely. And all I could see was like, you know, Trey had those candles on his amp, and like that's all you could see down there was like candles and like this, you know, ambient kind of space at the end of Ghost, which was really cool. But yeah, it's pretty upbeat, you know, and we talked a couple weeks ago, like when you're in the Hampton Winston-Salem portion of this tour, you're getting like, you know, only a few songs, right? Like this first set is very song heavy. And I think there's, you know, the Runaway Gym in kind of the middle of the set there is kind of the only notable part of the set when I went back. I mean, it's good and it's all like, it, you know, it has that 97 sound. I don't know if you guys agree going back to it, but it was a little bit less thrilling than I remember it being in person.
What about the Black Eyed Katie? I mean, two songs later, sort of a nonstop segment of Ghost, Wilson, Funky Bitch, and it's a phenomenal Black Eyed Katie, and probably underrated. Anything else from that first set that's worth mentioning? I guess it didn't make that much of an impression on you.
No, I mean, we were having so much fun, you know, and I remember like I had brought some friends with me who weren't huge Phish fans. And I think it was a couple people's first show. And, you know, it just, when I think back on the night, like I remember just being so happy to be at a Phish show in the fall, like, and part of it, and I was going to ask you guys about this because it was a sort of coming of age time for me. And, you know, I was a freshman in college and I was out on my own for the first time. And that overlapping with these shows, these handful of shows, five or six shows that I saw this tour, it's hard to separate that from like this feeling of freedom as an individual. But you guys were both in different, neither of you were freshmen in college at that time. Benji, is this a coming of age tour for you, or is it just a really good tour that is part of, you know, a longer journey?
Well, RJ, it's interesting because it is, my experience is kind of tied into what you're talking about, because that to me was December 95, which is, you know, one of my all time favorite months of Phish, and is so remarkably different than this tour. That was when I was doing I was doing the finals, you know, and for 97, I had just graduated. I was trying to figure out what I was actually, you know what? I hadn't fully graduated. I put my college career on hold and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And in between figuring it out, I knew I wanted to be on Phish tour, you know, or see Phish as often as I could. I saw them 9 times on this tour in between figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. And, you know, Phish was hugely influential in that, and that you'd go to these shows and you would feel this sort of endless possibility. You know, and I think that's the freedom that you're talking about.
I felt the same kind of freedom. Like Phish, in back in those days, I honestly had two lives. I had the now father of two, I guess a 1 and a 4-year-old in 97, late 97. And a work, a career. My wife at the time, who's now a huge Phish head, wasn't a Phish head, but probably not because she didn't want to be, probably just because she was a mom of young kids and I was the one that was working by going to Phish tour. And that was like my freedom. So any chance I got, I would go on tour. And I honestly, I wasn't really thinking, now I'm on fall 97 tour. I was just like, now I'm on the bus again.
Huh. That's awesome.
Fellas, it is, it's time for us to ring the bell. Of course, there is no bell. What do you want to bet that we would have? RJ, maybe for the next season 5, maybe we can afford to put in the budget for a bell right here. The bell would mean that it's set break. So we will be back in exactly 15 seconds.
Hey listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than 1 million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's distrokid with a capital K, .com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's distrokid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of The Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, And I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts. And new episodes come out every Monday.
And we are back. We've got the whole team here as I'm sitting here with Benji, and RJ is in the hot, RJ's in the hot seat actually right now. And I wanted to point out something. Guns aren't fast, you guys. Bullets are fast. Guns are not. And they had to fire the fish person who came up with that slogan right after this tour. But anyway, RJ, set two, let's get to it. Second set opens with Stash. Was Stash one of the songs of this tour in your mind?
Yeah, I think so. I think because it got out there, you know, and it was one of the songs of the tour that I guess bucked the trend of the cow funk, you know. It kind of like it was like the counterpoint to the funk. Like it made, you know, this is like a classic Tension release. I mean, this whole thing is just amazing. And I don't know how many times I've said this season about these Fall 97 shows, but that's one of the most notable things to me is like that this really does kind of like, it's almost more about these like intense jams than it is about the funk when you go back to it. And this Stash is a great, great example of it.
Yeah, I agree. Looking back and re-listening to this tour, it's the shreddy songs too, in which, you know, we put the cow funk label, the groove label on the tour, but then you go back and that was just one element of it. You know, they had all the other fish elements a part of it. And of course, fans were freaking out on, I mean, fans are always freaking out, but they were freaking out on the 2021 summer tour, the beginning of Fish 4.0, because on any given night, there's this idea and this, you know, expectation almost that any given song could get the extended type two treatment and be, you know, go long. But that was also the case all these years earlier in 1997. There was, you know, the AC/DC bad from Hampton, of course, the famous Runaway Jim from Worcester. And then this Julius, it doesn't quite have the same notoriety, but it does go type two and goes out there. So tell us about it.
Oh man, I don't even know where to start really. It's interesting that the Julius, like the lyrics and the song part, you get what you typically get, which is like fishermen yelling and kind of like, you know, keeping the jam going. And then it just kind of, it takes off and there doesn't seem to be any slowing down or like, you know, what we're used to now, especially with songs that don't get jammed out that much, when they do, it's like, there's like a slow down thing. And then it's like, and then it kind of takes off again, you know, or they like decide to take it in a direction. This just feels like it's just straightforward. I mean, 17 minutes is quite a long time. And I didn't even like really remember that it went into like, you know, there's some funky aspects, but there's also just like, it's like truly exploratory, you know, that's what it feels like to me. Like it doesn't follow a specific path. It's like they're going in and out of a bunch of different styles. And it's pretty amazing. Just given the tour that like Julius is a song that just ended up being jammed out a couple times. I don't know. It kind of blew me away listening to it today.
We'll be right back.
I know what you mean about that. Like that slow down point is kind of like the part where they're all looking at each other and listening, like, where's this going to go? They're kind of like the audience at that moment. They're kind of listening, hoping a thread becomes something different, you know, becomes something amazing. And it often does, especially in 1997, it sure did. Julius, in this case, unfinished, Slave was unfinished. Did it feel like the ripcord was being pulled, or was it just that the band was shredding so hard they were flowing from one place to another?
No, it was there. It was just one long piece of improv. I mean, the Slave being like one of the only versions I can think of that goes in this dark direction. I mean, I don't know, Benji, like if others come to mind, it's the only one that I can think of where it really like now they do that with Hood sometimes, but more like intentionally take it, you know, and then bring it back up. But this is just like it. I mean, I don't know. Like this feels like a totally unique version of the song, and I'm not sure that it's appropriate to do with Slave to the Traffic Light. What do you think?
I mean, I see what you're saying. I think it was, you know, they were very much caught up in the moment, and which is a good thing and what we want. So, RJ, I have a question for you that is a question we've been asking a lot. But first, it occurs to me that a question that we've never asked, that I don't think has ever been asked, is, and that's for Tom. Tom, you know, going back to this Julius, to me, I remember when I first heard it, it was the day that Hoist came out. And I remember, you know, going into my dorm room and putting it on with my friends. And it is one of those songs that Phish does this really well with like Maze, for instance, where the lyrics and the music seem very much matched up. Do you remember, did Julius, when you went to Trey with the lyrics, did the lyrics come first, or was it matched to the music?
So I remember, like, all of a sudden it popped into my head, this incident. So this one was completely written without me. So one of those where I gave him lyrics, and, you know, with Trey, you never know, will those be, you know, turned into, you know, garbage? Will it be, you know, will it rapping Phish or something, or instead will it be lyrics, or will he post it up on his dorm room door for months like McGrupp? You never know when you send Trey lyrics if they'll ever even become a song. But this one, when I heard about it next, he had kind of come up with this amazing song, but it was strange because he called me and left me a message, and I'm kind of glad I didn't answer, because he had this choir there of, you know, they were Black people, and he was asking specifically if the word brother was referring to, like, the guy was like, I'm not sure if we want to sing When You Lay It on a Brother. And I don't know how I would have answered that to that guy at that moment, because it was sort of one of those things, just, you know, I just sent it and forgot it. So if he had called me out on that right then, it would have been an unusual call for me to receive. But anyway, Trey was able to answer their concerns, obviously. But yeah, lyrics first, Trey did everything else after. And I missed a call that I'm glad that I missed from the studio. Well,
It's the perfect marriage of music and lyrics and the lyrical context.
And Benji, I just want to say one more thing about the Julius. Just, we talked to, I'd said, like, you know, there's a lot of different things happening. And I will say that the first 12 minutes or so is just a straight ahead blues jam, you know, and they were just like, they didn't really back off of that theme at all for a long time. And I guess that's maybe what we would be used to at this point, is the 10 to 11 minute really rocking Julius. And then there's just this extra 5 or 6 minutes, which is just wild, that goes into this, you know, 17 minute Slave, which is just crazy. But Benji, are you okay with them messing with Slave?
I am okay with the messing with Slave, because I think that nothing is sacred. And I think, you know, it doesn't mean that it's going to be my favorite Slave, or that I'm going to think that it was a good idea, but I'm okay with them messing with it.
Are you okay with them messing with Lawn Boy, Benji?
As a matter of fact, Tom, this is still Lawn Boy.
Well, It's sort of like Hood, I feel the same way about. Like the ones where they go into like the minor key and like kind of, you know, I like the Hood's just like very, it's a serene and peaceful.
Don't mess with my bliss, dudes.
Well, yeah, yes, exactly.
See, the Hood is the one where I would say that I do. In fall 95, there was a short-lived trend of them not finishing Hoods, where there was this no, you should feel good about Hood part. And I remember, of course, Phish fans on the internet coming up with every conspiracy theory for every little thing they do, said maybe the band doesn't feel good about this tour. Maybe this is them giving us a message. You know, it didn't feel like that to me. It just felt like they were experimenting by leaving the end off. And to me, that always left me feeling a little incomplete. And so I remember in Worcester, 12/5/95, there was a moment, it's one of my favorite moments of Phish ever, because it sounds like they're not going to finish Hood. And I remember people around me being nervous, like, they're not going to finish it, are they? Because, you know, we had heard about it on this tour. They weren't finishing it.
And then Tension is high.
All of a sudden, Trey looks up and you can see kind of the light bulb go off in his head. And he like does like this. And with one little sweeping moment movement of his guitar pick as he kind of scrapes the strings, the whole band just kind of slams back into it. And Kuroda lights up the stage again. And
You can feel good.
Yeah, and they just go right back. It sounded like a plane landing, and like they weren't going to finish it. And then all of a sudden, going back into it was the ultimate tension and release for me.
Amazing, because if they don't tell you that you can feel good about Hood, then you can't feel good about Hood.
And obviously you have to read a message into it that maybe they're not feeling good. You know?
Yeah, right, exactly. Tom, oh, sorry, Benji. I just want to ask another question of Tom. Tom, the Stash, between Stash and Julius was bouncing around the room. I just want to know, like, you and Trey have written a bunch of songs just even in the past few years. And I know that bouncing is or has been kind of at the top of your list of all the songs that you guys have written. And I was thinking about it today because I think it's a good, very short, you know, kind of landing after the Stash and before the Julius. And it's a really nice version. How do you feel about that song now? Like, is it still at the very top?
I forget. There was either we had heard a version of it or we were together for some playing of it or replaying of it. And we kind of turned to each other and we both agreed. And this could have been 20 years ago. Could have been 25 years ago, exactly. When we said, we both agreed that Bouncy was the best song that we'd ever written. And I don't think we'd say that today. I mean, I think in the very recently, Trey and I both, again, were together and agreed that Leaves might be the best song we've ever written. But so it changes, you know. Tide goes in, tide goes out, new songs come by and we choose different favorites. But at the moment, I would say Bouncing probably isn't on my list of favorite Phish songs that I've written.
It's not on my list of favorite songs that I want to see them play live because they don't often do any improvisation with it or anything like that. But getting into Phish, I remember it was one of those songs that to me was it had that fingerprint of Phish that no other band could play the song.
It was the quintessential Phish sound. It had the ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
Ding, ding. It was upbeat, everything about it. It had sort of wacky lyrics, everything about it. And it really intricate harmonies and stuff.
Yeah. And this is my first live version. This is the first time I saw it live.
Very majestic too. It has a very majestic sound to it. Like you are just waking up from sleep. You know,
nice.
RJ, you know, we've been asking this question a lot on here for the fall 97 shows. There are some of these, you know, there's obviously the big ones like Hampton and Denver and Albany. But then for a lot of these less obvious sleeper shows, where do you place this one within the context of fall 97?
You know, that it's interesting because I was looking at the Fishnet comments earlier. You guys know Wally, you know, Wally Holland, Wax Banks, you know, he wrote a book on fall 97. And it's great. And I talked to him about it a long time ago, but his review on this show on Fishnet, it's a two step review. One is if you're going to skip one fall 97 show, it can be this one. And then number two is don't skip any Fall 97 shows. So I kind of agree with them. Like this, I feel like the replay value is really like the Runaway Jim in the first set, the Julius, the Stash is really fun. And then this kind of strange slave and the rest of it is fine, but feels a little bit disjointed going back to it. You know, like it felt like there was a little bit of ups and downs in terms of the flow and kind of the execution, which I think is pretty rare in this tour. So I'd put it like toward the bottom tier probably.
And you may have just answered this, although, you know, conspiracy theories aside and the slightly disturbing slave to the traffic light aside, close your eyes and think of this night. Does anything else come to mind? It could even be a story or something. Like you said, you were a college student getting your freedom.
Yeah. You know, I have no idea how we got home from Cleveland to Toledo, but I think that we got home that night. It's a 2-hour drive. I have no recollection of it whatsoever. And I hope I wasn't driving. I don't think it's because I was on anything or I think I just
couldn't.
I have no recollection of, you know, a car full of 18-year-olds getting, you know, driving 2 hours on the turnpike at whatever it was, midnight. And I'm just very thankful that everyone's still alive.
What, 25 years later, you don't remember driving home?
I know. Right. I mean, I can barely remember what happened yesterday. But
how do you not remember that? Well, I think that's going to do it for us today. Benji, any other questions for our guest?
What's the original cast of Leave It to Beaver? But other than that, no, I think we're good.
Wow. All right. Well, that's going to have to do it for us today. And if you're watching on YouTube, you're looking at the face of Undermine. And thanks to my fellow co-hosts and house guests, RJB and Benji Eisen. Thanks to the Osiris team that we have behind us, especially Eric Lemarenko and Matt Dwyer. And thank you for listening. By the way, if you need tickets for anything coming up, like say Fish's New Year's Eve run, then I'd encourage you to check out Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. Click on cashortrade.org and may the ticket gods be ever in your favor. And if you're playing along, we hope you're playing along, then go home tonight and queue up 12-6-97 from the Palace in Auburn Hills, Michigan via Live Fish. Our special guest tomorrow plays bass in a band that you may have seen not too far from there. That's the only clue we'll give you until tomorrow. Good night, Cleveland. Good night, RJ, and good night, Benji.
Good night.
Osiris.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11. Oh.